Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
He has sold millions of picture books all over the world. Children everywhere have grown up with his beautiful creations. There's the boy who found a wee penguin at his door. There's one who ate books. There's a grieving girl who tried to stuff her heart into a bottle to cope with it. And the iconic book that started it all, How to Catch a Star, is now 20 years old and he's released a brand new sequel. Oliver Jeffers is live from Belfast. Good morning, Oliver.
Good morning, Oliver.
How are you doing?
I'm keeping all right, thank you.
Congratulations on the new book, Where to Hide a Star.
Oh, thank you.
Going into the sequel, or it probably would have brought you all the memories of how your life started out with one story about a boy catching a star and where it has landed you now.
Yeah, it was that a little bit. You know, it's been a while since I'd worked with those characters, painted them, and part of the reason for doing so was when we accidentally moved back to Northern Ireland from Brooklyn a couple of years ago, all of the furniture from my first studio that I had put into storage came out, and you know, all those original materials and sketchbooks were in the drawers. And coming up to the 20th anniversary and reading those books to my own children now, it sort of all just put it back in my head.
What was going on in your life when you published the first book 20 years ago?
Oh, I had just graduated from university, from the art college here in Belfast, actually.
Yeah.
I had been working in a bookshop and I had thought, right, I'm trying to become an artist and I will try to get this book published and, you know, maybe that'll help supplement my income somewhat.
But it was a hit from the get-go, wasn't it? You went on book deals.
Yes, it was. I just actually found some of the original letters and correspondence when I'm cleaning up my studio from that time ago. And, you know, I think the original print run was only about 5,000 copies.
Wow. And you got a book deal in America as well. I mean, I presume that really sets you off as the international figure that you are now.
Yeah. It when, you know, doing the research in how you get a book published, I looked up the publishers that were publishing the books that I enjoyed, and I just thought, you know, shy boys don't get sweets. I'll chance my arm here. I sent off to the 10 biggest publishers in the UK and 10 in the US, and I was expecting a very long campaign of following up, have you read it yet? But it landed both times on the right person's desk at the right time, and I managed to get a meeting with both HarperCollins in the UK and Philomel Books, who's now part of Penguin Random House in the US.
What did they say about the story? What really struck them as, oh yeah, this'll work?
I still don't know what works about them, and I'm not terribly inclined to find out either, for the fear of if taking it apart, won't be able to put it back together.
Yeah.
Over the years, I suppose my guess is that the books are simple. They are geographically vague. The characters are kind of empty, but they're about real experiences, and so people can apply themselves to it. But How to Catch a Star, for some reason, really catches very young readers. Maybe it's the colours. I honestly don't know.
And obviously the parents who buy them and read them out loud to the kids.
Well, yeah, because no matter how well you're doing as a 2 or 3 year old, you're not sticking your hand in your pocket and buying a book for yourself.
Yeah. We see a lot of kind of political themes, or more, I suppose it's more fair to say, social messages in your books ever since, like Begin Again last year, which is about greed, community, climate and all of that. Do you remember what you set out to do when you were a young fella putting this book out into the world?
With How to Catch a Star, the book started taking a turn towards the human interest in a sort of a very real change-making way about 10 years ago. And I think a part of that came from having kids for the first time and sort of looking around and like, who's talking about these things? The things that I'd had been feeling and hearing and thinking for a while, but hadn't necessarily outwardly verbalized. And then in 2016, it did feel like a very scary time. You know, Brexit had just happened. Trump was running for presidency. And here I was trying to explain how the world works to somebody who had just shown up. And I think a part of me was like, you know what, despite all this, the noise and the fear and the anger and the shouting and the division and the blame, etc., I wanted to remind my son that life is beautiful and it's a beautiful planet. And so sort of leaning into more some of the simpler, hopeful things. And in the act of doing that, I kind of realized that no matter the difference between people, we all sort of want the same things. I think we just get confused in the communication of those and blame other people for why we're not getting the story that we thought we were promised. And a lot of the early questions that were kind of came up from Here We Are, eventually after ruminating on them for some time, went into that book Begin Again. But there's a few others in there that are about the state of the world and about the state of humanity.
I love the way you're describing it there, and I think you're describing maybe a lot of the creative heads coming out of Belfast at the moment, because the outside world looking in at the North, it's like, well, they wake up every morning only thinking about division and us versus them, rather than just the general worldly concerns the rest of us have.
Well, you know, but I think that the most prominent worldly concern is us versus them, not just Northern Ireland. And that's one of the things I woke up to after moving back here, is that the USA it's got itself into exactly the same boat.
Yeah, because you were in Brooklyn all these years in the meantime.
Yeah.
What did you experience in your time in America? Because I know you're still based there. You go there for work mostly, I presume now.
Yeah. My fine art studio is still there. I am back and forth an awful lot, but I think one of the things that I've sort of come to realize is that it's the experience about being in America is, you know, one thing that sets it apart is that it's the hope and the idealism is palpable, especially in cities like New York.
Yeah.
But the geographical isolation, I think, torments it, where there's not there's not a sense of what it actually is like to be the neighboring country of multiple countries.
Yeah.
And I think that plays into the paranoia that unfortunately is causing a lot of the division.
The states are kind of even against each other.
Oh, yeah.
We've been talking a lot about Belfast on this program, you know, having a real moment, cultural moment, the writers, the music, the movies coming out of there. Do you sense that since you've come back to Belfast too?
Yeah, I think I've always sensed it. You know, I sort of joke that there's something in the water, you know, for a city the size of Belfast, well, the population's, you know, less than 500,000 people. Mm-hmm. We seem to punch above our weight. And maybe that, you know, there is that old saying that great art comes from times of great need. And, you know, I don't know, maybe there's a grit and a determination here to make art for the real reasons for making art. And it just comes out. But yeah, I've always sensed that there's something about this place and the sort of people it produces. And I always used to infuriate me when I would come back from New York, or when I was staying in Belfast for Christmas, and would meet people who would recognize me and say, "Isn't it great you've done so well, even though you're from Belfast?" And I always used to say, "I was like, no, do you know what? One of the reasons I think I've done great is because I'm from Belfast."
Right. And you've been speaking about the cultural identity as well of the North, haven't you, from your previous work, which is,
yeah.
I presume, I'm just guessing from your name, and this is the wrong thing to do as often as well.
Or are you going to do the old try and guess my religion?
I presume you grew up in a unionist.
The alphabet next.
I presume you grew up in a unionist background, even though
no,
I know.
No, working class Catholic.
Okay.
Was an altar boy and everything. Accidentally set fire to the church one Easter Sunday by setting the candle too close to the altar, and I had to put it out with holy water. I think the name Jeffers actually comes up from the French Huguenots. Oh, I don't know. Yeah, it's a long, long time ago.
Really?
My mother's maiden name was McLaughlin, but my grandmother, Ginger Jeffers, she ran a chemist shop on the Falls Road, and actually I remember watching The Name of the Father with her in the room, and
yeah.
Jerry Conlon's the protagonist, and he used to work for her as a delivery boy, and she said, "Oh, he was evil." Yeah, she was like, "Oh, he deserved everything he got. If he hadn't got dumped for something he didn't do, he would have got dumped for something he did do." So you know, the her opinion of just this little mischievous boy.
The gossipy rumours with no evidence, we should say, in Belfast.
You know, I was like, this is
a strange... She
meant
it cheeky. Yeah, cheeky.
Yeah. Yes. But grew up as a working class Catholic, but then I went to an integrated secondary school.
Right.
Just because my dad's a teacher, and he always... thought that one of the big problems was the division in education at a very early point, so Catholics don't actually meet Protestants until university stages an awful lot.
That's desperate.
It's changing an awful lot now, but still, you know, how few schools are integrated compared to the greater number of them in total is kind of shocking.
If they had done that in 1998, as part of the good.
I think that would have been a very smart move.
Yeah. But there was always a way to find division, even with people next door to each other.
Yeah.
So that exposes my total ignorance anyway. But I have noticed you publicly, you back the Alliance Party. You have done in the past.
Yeah, I do. I do think that this idea of representing only one half the community is not going to get us very far. The world is changing, and I think Northern Ireland needs to change with that world. And unfortunately, we are so privy to outside forces in a way kind of unlike at any point in history, you know, like the global markets with Brexit, with the European Union, with now a Trump administration who's less likely to want to support Ireland in the same way a Biden administration did. It's like it's you know, whenever we go to the polling the booths, what is it we're actually casting a vote for? And oftentimes we go against our own best interests. And I think that is one of the things that sort of filtered down into my work, is wondering why people would rather prove that they're right rather than be actually better.
Yes, or sometimes calling someone else out as though that's activism and somehow going to make the world better.
Yeah. So, and that's my approach to whenever I'm talking about anything in social media, is not to just add anger and blame to the noisy echo chamber, but to, I think, promote or prompt some sort of positive discussion or call to action in a positive, in an optimistic, hopeful way.
How does your imagination work? Are you thinking in illustrations when you have a story, or what do you imagine?
I don't know if anybody knows how their imagination works. I don't think about things in terms of here's a drawing, I'm going to put some words to it, or here's a story I've come up with, I'm going to decorate it. It is the way I've kind of taken to describing an idea or a concept is more like a feeling, and asking kids if when they ask, can you remember a dream that you've had, and how does it come back to you? Does it come as a story? Does it come as the way it looked? Or is it something deeper than both of those things? Is it a feeling? And they get it. And I think that's sort of what the best way I can describe it is. It's like a feeling. I've never really known what to call myself, whether that's an artist or an author or an activist or whatever. But once when I was at, I do a lot of work in the climate arena, and I got to make a sculpture at COP26 when it was in Glasgow a couple of years ago. And when they went to register me there, they didn't have a box to check for artists, which I thought was very telling. You know, here's one of the biggest climate conferences in the world, and it's like art is seen as an afterthought. But they called me an observer and a translator, and I thought actually that's surprisingly apt for what I do.
Translation, as in translating all these thoughts we have in the world into
feelings. Yes, so feelings, I try to observe what it is that people are saying and feeling, and then how can I translate that into ways in which other people can feel the same way.
How to Catch a Star is the original. This is Where to Hide a Star. I don't know if you can spoil a picture book, but it has that message, doesn't it, of meeting people from way beyond where we are. And, you know, the boy in the book obviously is a lovely character who doesn't want to upset anyone.
Yeah, it's, when I look back, because the books did take definitely more of a direct lean in towards discourse of the state of the world. But all of the books, I realise now, had been speaking about that in some ways. Just, I think, because if you're interested in telling good stories, you're going to naturally hit on some sort of theme or value or moral that applies to most people. Otherwise, they just wouldn't find that story very satisfying. And yes, this one does talk about sharing, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of the first things that we teach our kids is how to share with each other, yet it's something we as adults forget how to do.
And there's a bit of a kind of a heist moment as well.
A rescue operation, shall we say.
Exactly. Obviously, as an artist, you appreciate tattoos, and you've lots of them. Your wife's teeth inspired some of them, I believe.
Yes. I wonder how this story got out. Yeah, well, did I say this somewhere before?
It is indeed, yeah.
Oh, okay. with anybody out there who has more than one child, I don't know how common this is. We were warned, but the second one shows up in a hurry. So after being a couple of days late, it was Brooklyn minus 16. I mean, the weather was shocking. There was big snow banks. We almost didn't make it to the hospital just because of the snow. It's middle of January. And so we just about got into the maternity ward, and Suzanne had started giving birth, and so no time for painkillers or anything, and she bit on my finger to ease the pain, and there's doctors running around screaming, nurses sort of, there's a whole hive of attention, and I lean over and whisper to the nurse beside me, thinking nobody else can hear me, is there anything else she can bite on? And everybody stopped and looked at me, including my wife, and I was like, okay, right, go on, keep on biting then. And so the teeth marks are still very clearly indented there the next day, and I just thought that I'm going to get that moment commemorated.
That was a great idea. So you got a tattoo, you got the bite marks tattooed in.
Yeah, I did.
Since there was no sign of a stick nearby.
No.
Would be something.
Yeah.
And
any time I've injured my hand after that or before that, that's the only time. So the first thing my wife asked was like, which hand? I was like, does it matter?
Because you also had a ligament surgery, did you, when you...
Yeah, I've had a torn ligament in my wrist, and I've had shoulder issues. So I've had a couple of different surgeries, yeah.
But you've tattooed the one on your, particularly because of the scar.
Yeah, the entry wounds, yes, the scars from the surgery.
Yeah, interesting idea. So you look down every time and see...
Well, it was more to just sort of remember that, you know, to treat my body with, I suppose, to be gentle with myself. Mm-hmm.
To be good to yourself and know that you're fragile.
Exactly.
I suppose. When you look at the success now over the last 20 years, because you've had incredible stuff. Apple has made a short film, Here We Are, that's narrated by Meryl Streep and other A-listers as well. What kind of stands out? What are you most proud of having achieved?
I don't look back very often. There are paintings that I've done that I think I'll be remembered for. There's books I think I'll be remembered for. But I suppose, you know, one of the things that I'm most proud of is that making books is relatively straightforward. Making paintings is relatively straightforward. But making public art is insanely difficult just because of the amount of people you have to convince, the amount of money you have to raise. And I think just with that in mind and just how difficult it was, the Our Place in Space, public art sculpture that was kind of a way of looking at ourselves from a distance in the form of a scale model of our solar system, which took up to 9 miles, and it moved around a little bit. Just the insanity of the ambition of that project and that it worked, just I think was a real moment of I'm glad this happened. I'm proud of me and the people that I worked with.
And it sums up all the themes that you're really interested in.
Yeah, it does.
I'm delighted to see that you're going to be signing copies of this new book, Where to Hide a Star, in Dublin this weekend. So you're going to be in Easton and Arnott's on Friday, Easton Dundrum the following day. What do children generally say to you when they come up to you looking for a sign?
Oh, all sorts. You know, because I've been doing it for 20 years now, so kids come up and they'll. So, you know, the real young ones won't really clock who I am until I start drawing, and then they'll get it. An awful lot of time it is the parents. But, you know, more and more there's slightly older kids who will come in costume, which is really fantastic.
Oh, lovely.
But then, you know, there's 22-year-olds who are, like, graduating art school going, I grew up on your books. And that's a bit wild to see and think about.
You're not old enough to have that.
Yeah. It's like... Yeah, you're trying to kid me here, aren't you?
Still in his 40s. Easton Arnott's on Friday, Easton Dundrum in Dublin on Saturday. It's been a pleasure chatting to you, Oliver Jeffers.
Thank you, Oliver.
Good luck to you.
Enjoy it. Bye-bye.